The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Hi, good evening. I'm Ken Kalfas. I was asked to happy to present Martin Amis this evening. I've been asked to ask you to make sure that all your cell phones are off. Also, not to take any photographs in the auditorium. All phasers should be on stun. Anyway, it's a huge honor to welcome Martin Amis to the Free Library and to the Amelia Gordon Memorial Lecture tonight. Many of us have been longtime admirers of Mr. Amis' work, celebrating the brashness of his style, his humor, the raging clarity with which he sees the world, and his uncompromised literary ambition. I think it's fair to say that no single Martin Amis book is like the other, yet they all aspire to give a sense of what it means to live in these historical times. Mr. Amis's first novel was The Rachel Papers, published in 1973 when he was 24. Since then, he has published 26 books, including London Fields, Visiting Mrs. Nabokov, and The Information. My personal favorite is Money, about a British director who comes to the States to work on a bad science fiction film. The film stars a craggy old Hollywood veteran and a famous, hilariously dumb blonde actress. The novel's a bit of a Romana Clay, but I'll let you find the clay yourself. The initials of the actress is FF, though. Mr. Amis' 1991 novel, Time's Arrow, recalled the history of the Nazi death camps in a striking original way, backwards. His new novel, House of Meetings, which you will read from tonight, focuses on that other show-stopping production of mid-20th century Europe, the Soviet Gulag. It's about two brothers who are sent to the same labor camp, the woman they both love, and what happens to them after they return. They're intensely romantic men who, to survive, must pretend to be cynical. Indeed, they have to insist on their cynicism, brutally defend their cynicism. House of Meetings extends from the Stalin era to the Putin era, up to the events around the 2004 Beslan massacre. One of the brothers comments, "Russia is the nightmare country, and always the compound nightmare, always the most talented nightmare." I myself have written two books set in Russia, and people ask me, "Why are you so interested in the place?" I have several answers. The one most relevant to our purposes tonight is that Russia is a country of people very much like ourselves in character and deportment, with whom we share the patrimony of Western culture. And they have been wrung through the grinder of history. Their history shows us who we could be in very different circumstances. Thus, it shows us who we really are. This is the highest challenge for the novelist. The novelist that I have the honor to present to you tonight is meeting this challenge at the top of his game. Please welcome Martin Amis.
Good evening. Thank you all very much for coming. It's always a thrill to be in Philadelphia. It's a jungle out there. In fact, I'd like to tell you about something weird that happened to me today on the way here, on the airplane from Boston. Because the publisher's paying for it, I was in first class, and there's about 16 seats in there and one other passenger. And then just before takeoff, it filled up with a family, first class section, three generations, including three little children. And I thought, what kind of family is this that puts its children in first class? And it didn't look like a wildly prosperous family. Then I remembered that at Logan there had been 15, 16 police cars and limousines out on the tarmac, all with their lights flashing, and lots of cops walking around. And as the family settled down, a huge soldier, American soldier, came on and sat with them and among them. And the mother, the older lady, was crying and being comforted. I at last realized that, and the captain came on and said, we have the honor today of taking the coffin of Lieutenant Keith Callahan from Boston to Philadelphia. He was going to go on by road to, I think it's State College for burial. And when we landed, the captain said, please let the Callahan family leave first as out of respect. And they gathered their things and got off the plane. And then from behind me, there was this very cautious, deferential applause from the coach. It was a strange moment. Somber moment. You have some idea what this book is about. The House of Meetings refers to a very strange institution in Soviet Russia, which is there were conjugal visits in the Gulag, a kind of ridiculous and appalling hangover from the progressivist, enlightened early years of Bolshevism. The idea that you're, you know, tremendously grown up and mature, and this is how you run a society. You know, of course, these millions of slaves in the, and that's what they were. It was a slave system. It wasn't really a detention system. It was slavery was what it was about. That these men, you know, should have these virile encounters with their wives. Although, of course, it was always tragic. For various reasons, which we'll touch on some of them. as was said earlier, the two men love the same woman, and the older one is the narrator, the eye, is sort of tall and handsome and romantic-looking, and it's the younger one who is yokelish and ill-favored, and a poet and a pacifist, who, when he arrives in camp, reveals that he's married this woman, Zoya, whom the narrator is in love with. So their 10-year sentences are much colored by this fact. When he tells him that he's married Zoya, on arrival the first day in the Gulag, the older brother, trying to absorb this fact, says that if he can survive this, his brother's marriage to the woman he loves, then he'll never die. My little brother came to camp in 1948. I was already there at the height of the war between the broods and the bitches. By the way, the whole book is addressed to the narrator's 24-year-old black American stepdaughter who's living in Chicago, where he's spent the last 20 years. At the height of the war between the broods and the bitches. Now, that wouldn't be a bad opening sentence for the narrative proper, and I'm impatient to write it. But not yet. Not yet, not yet, my precious. This is what the poet Auden used to say to the lyrics, the sprawling epistles that seemed to be lobbying him for premature birth. It is too early now for the war between the brutes and the bitches. There will be war in these pages, inevitably. I fought in 15 battles, and in the 7th, I was almost castrated by a secondary missile, a 3-pound iron bolt, which lodged itself in my inner thigh. When you get a wound as bad as that, for the first hour, you don't know whether you're a man or a woman, or whether you're old or young, or who your father was, or what your name is. Even so, an inch or two further up, as they say, and there would have been no story to tell, because this is a love story. All right, Russian love, but still love. The love story is triangular in shape, and the triangle is not equilateral. I sometimes like to think that the triangle is isosceles. It certainly comes to a very sharp point. Let's be honest, though, and admit that the triangle remains brutally scalene. I trust, my dear, he's talking to his stepbrother, that you have a dictionary nearby. You never needed much encouragement in your respect for dictionaries. Scalene, from the Greek skalenos, unequal. It's a love story, so of course I must begin with the House of Meetings. House of Meetings. It was with some ceremony, I remember, that I showed my younger brother the place where he would entertain his bride. I say bride. They'd been married for 8 years, but this would be their first night together as husband and wife. You head north from the Zona, and after half a mile you strike off to the left and climb the steep little lane and the implausible flight of old stone steps, and there it is, beyond, on the slope of Mount Schweinsteiger, the two-story chalet called the House of Meetings, and to the side its envied annex, a lone log cabin, like an outpost of utter freedom. Just the one room, of course, the narrow cot with its furry undersheet and deadweight grey blanket, the water barrel with the tin mug chained to it, the spotless slops bucket with its tactful wooden lid, and then the chair, armless, backless, and the waiting supper tray. 2 fist-sized lumps of bread, a whole herring, slightly green around the edges, and the big jug of cold broth with at least 4 or 5 beads of fat set into its surface. Many hours had gone into this, and many hands. Lev, the younger brother, Lev whistled. I said, "Well, kid, we've come a long way. Look." "Jesus Christ," he said, and I produced from my pocket the squat thermos of vodka, the 6 cigarettes rolled out of the state newspaper, and the 2 candles. Maybe he was still recovering from the power hose and the shearer. There were droplets of sweat on his upper lip, but then he gave me the look I knew well, the mirthless rictus with the 2 inverted chevrons in the middle of his brow. This I took with considerable confidence to be an expression of sexual doubt. Sexual doubt, the exclusively male burden. "Tell me, my dear, what is it there for?" The utilitarian answer, I suppose, would be that it's meant to stop us from reproducing if we're weak and sickly or just too old. Perhaps also this would have been at the planning stage of the masculine idea. It was felt that the occasional fiasco, or the fiasco as an ever-present possibility, might help to keep men honest. This would have been at the planning stage. "Lev, my boy," I said, "you've got a goddamn paradise in here." And then I told him, with all due diffidence, not to expect too much. "She won't, so don't you either." We embraced. As I ducked out of the shed and straightened up, I saw something I hadn't noticed on the windowsill, and much magnified now by a lens-like swelling in the glass. It was a test tube with rounded base, kept upright by a hand-carved wooden frame. A single stemless wildflower floated in it, overflowed it, an amorous burgundy. I remember thinking that it looked like an experiment on the male idea. Poetic experiment, perhaps, but still an experiment. The guard stepped forward and gestured with his firearm. I was to precede him down the path. Coming the other way, and also under escort, was my sister-in-law. That walk of hers, that famous tottering swagger, it set a world in motion. By now, the 5-week Arctic summer was underway. It was as if nature woke up in July and realized how badly she had neglected her guests. And then, of course, she completely overdid it. There was something gushing and hysterical in the show she put on. The sun with its dial turned up and staring in constant attendance. The red carpet of wildflowers, the colors lush but sharply irritant, making the eyes itch. And the thrilled mosquitoes, the size of hummingbirds. I walked on under a hairnet of midges, of gnats, and no-see-ums. There was, I remember, an enormous glinting grey cloud overhead. Its leading edge had a chewed look and was about to shred or grate itself into rain. Now, we now go ahead 100 pages and find out how that night went. I've already told you about the evening of July 31st. I went to Count Christoph's coffee shop, trying not to laugh. He gave me a cup of hot black muck. Trying not to laugh, I drank it. There was a lecture on Iran I didn't go to. There was my tryst with Tanya, her notched mouth, like a scar, marking time in what had once been her face. She was 24. Midnight came and midnight went. The impersonation of a reasonable man, that's tiring. The impersonation of someone reasonably good, that's tiring too. I should have slept, of course, but how was I supposed to do that? I had seen a woman who looked like a woman, Zoya, side on, with a hole of her emotion in the white cotton dress, one hand raised to steady the raincoat thrown over her shoulder, the other swinging a crammed straw bag, the Brazilian backside, the Californian breasts, and all of it in syncopation against the beat as she moved down the path to the House of Meetings, where Lev stood. Around me in the dark, the prisoners were eating the dream meal, bolting it, wolfing it. I knew that dream, we all did, with loaves of bread the color of honey or mustard floating past you and turning to mist in your hands, on your lips, on your tongue. I had something else in my mouth. All night I walked and crawled across a landscape overlaid with grit, a desert, where each grain of sand, at some point or other, would have its time between my teeth. When I first saw him, Lev, out beyond the boundary rail, this is the next morning, I swear to God I thought he'd been blinded in the night. He was being led by the arm or dragged by the sleeve. Then the pig, the guard, just swung him out into the yard. Lev turned a full circle, swayed, steadied, and at last began to come forward. I thought too of his arrival in the February of 1948, 9 years ago, when he had felt his way out of the decontamination shed and moved into the darkness one step at a time, but not slowly, because he knew by then that there were always great distances to cross. Now he moved slowly. Now he was night blind at noon. As he drew nearer, I could tell that it was simpler than that, and he just wasn't interested in anything further than an inch from his face. The eyes, rather, were swiveled inward, where they were doing the work of decrease, of internal demotion. Lev came past me. His jaws toiled as if he was sucking purposefully on a lozenger or a sweet. Some hoarded bonbon, perhaps, maybe popped in there in parting by Zoya. I thought not. I thought he was trying to rinse out a new taste inside his mouth. For 72 hours he lay face down in his bunk. Not even the guards tried to make him stir. But this couldn't last. On the third morning, I waited for the barracks to clear, and then I approached. I stood over his curled form. Muttering, murmuring, I rubbed his shoulders until he opened his eyes. I said, "Work today, brother, food today." And I peeled him up from the boards and helped him down. Listen, I said, you can't stay silent forever. What's the worst that could have happened? All right, she's leaving you. His chin jerked up, and I was staring at his nostrils. He used to be a terrible stutterer, Lev, until he married Zoya, and his stutter disappeared overnight. But that was 8 years ago. His chin jerked up, and I was staring at his nostrils. I don't think Lev knew it until that moment. His stutter was back. Leaving me, he eventually managed to say, and he labored on, no, she wants to get married again, properly. She said she'd follow me anywhere, like a dog. Then all is clear, I said. You couldn't do it. Nobody can, not here. You know, in its whole history, I don't think there's ever been a single fuck in the House of Meetings. I could do it, he said. Everything worked. Then tell me. I'll tell you before I die, he said, and it took him a long time to get it out. I have crossed over, he said, fighting it, bringing everything to bear against it into the other half of my life. All that could be done was to help him with his norms and his rations, but he couldn't eat. He tried, and he couldn't eat. He turned his face away. He drank the water, and he could sometimes manage the tea, but nothing solid passed his lips until September. No one joked or smiled or said anything. His attempts to work, to eat, to talk, these were respected in silence by every prisoner. Okay, I think that'll do. It's not till just before the end of the novel that you find out what happened in the House of Meetings. Thank you. On a lighter note, to explain these, as you get older, you not only get steadily balder, bulkier, bunkier, you also get steadily blinder. Don't forget blinder. But perhaps that's not such a bad thing. I was reading the other day about a fancy new neurosis or even psychopathology called dysmorphic visualization disorder, otherwise known as perceived ugly syndrome. This is where you look into the mirror and see something even worse than... And dysmorphic visualization disorder is what I hope I've got. I'm banking on that being the case. But in truth, getting older is like auditioning for and then starring in a coarse, irresponsible, and above all, low-budget horror film. Where, as usual, they're saving the worst for last. Some questions, please.
On that note, I think it's time to start the questioning. Just for those of you who haven't been here before, what we'll do is, if you'll raise your hand, I'll point you out. Please wait for the mic. And absolutely. I'd like to start us off.
What do you see as the most prevalent trend in the modern novel today?
Ooh. It's hard to identify, but I can see a trend. I can see a trend. There have been several. I mean, postmodernism, the tricksy stuff, you know, the unreliable narrators and the double time schemes and that kind of thing, was a dead end, although it had amazing predictive power. And
right? It's on.
And life itself is tremendously postmodern now, as we see in all departments. But what's happening, I think, is that the literary novel is becoming less literary and more plot-driven. And you can see... A little example of why this is so, a little model, control experiment for why this is so, is look at poetry, which is more or less dead. It will continue as a minority interest area, but it is more or less dead. And the reason for that is that because life has accelerated, history has accelerated. What a poem does is very much go against that. A poem stops the clock. It stops the clock and says, let us examine this moment, this epiphany. Time will not be moving forward while we do this. And that's inimical to the modern sensibility. And when I'm reading some enormous piece in the New Yorker or the New York Review of Books about Iran or Iraq, and I see a poem in the middle of it, I always think, what's that doing there? You think I'm going to break off this piece and read a poem. This is resoundingly true of poetry, and will become increasingly true of fiction. And some of the great, wildly popular, brilliant books of perhaps 20 or 30 years ago are very static and, in our modern sense, inert and meditative and essayistic. And I don't see, and this is exactly the kind of novel I'm writing now, next. This is what we have absolutely no patience with and no time for. It may be even, some writers will be better at adapting to this than others. And you don't adapt for the market. You adapt because you're just as subject to these forces as anyone else. But some writers will adapt while retaining what's good about them. Others will perhaps lose what's good about them by following this urge for acceleration. So that's where I think it's going.
I guess arguably a difference between the gulags and the death camps is that the gulags were not called death camps. Nonetheless, I would imagine the mortality rates approach one another. So what I'm really wondering about is when you have a 10-year sentence to a gulag, I can't imagine that the sentenced person actually thinks they'll ever leave alive. And what I'm interested in, so the days have both an endlessness and an imminence of disappearance. What I'm interested in is how does someone like you get oneself imaginatively, that is, what experiences does one draw on to work up that level of despair and focus on quotidian details in the way that what I've read so far does so brilliantly?
Right. Well, no, they weren't death camps. If you're running a slave system, then you don't want them to die. There were execution camps in the Gulag, where all they did was kill people. But that's not quite the same as the Nazi death camps. It wasn't on that industrial scale. The difference is, I've written about this before, and I think everyone wonders which was worse, the German Holocaust or the Russian. And I think it's very clear that the Germans in the 30s and 40s were much more disgusting than the Russians, qualitatively more disgusting. One way of measuring this is just the question of aggression and vociferousness. The Russian Communist Party hoped for world revolution sometime or other, but Hitler, who expected his life to be short, wanted a Nazi planet, in the next 15 years. And the difference between the two is dramatized in June 1941, where the biggest army ever amassed came with no provocation, came steaming across the border to wage a war described by Hitler as a war of annihilation. He said, this won't be like the French, the war against France. This is a war of annihilation. And in fact succeeded in killing 25 million Russians. So an enormous difference in the level of virulence. And the other difference, in my view, clinching difference, is that the Gulag wasn't completely irrational. Not completely irrational, like the Holocaust. It had, the rationale was that the slave system made money, although Marx said that slavery was by definition non-productive. It didn't make money. It lost money from 1918 on. And everyone knew it lost money, except Stalin. Beria knew, Khrushchev knew, Kaganovich knew. But the problem was that no one dared tell Stalin that the camps lost money. And so it went on until 1953, and then it began to end within a few days of his death. The question of imagining these horrors, when I wrote Time's Arrow, a novel about the Holocaust, I, as Ken said, I sort of solved that problem in a way by doing it from the point of view of a perpetrator, a Nazi doctor. And that was, and also I had this rule that I would not make anything up, that when I got to Auschwitz, I would not add to what I had already found in the history books and in the writings of survivors. It seemed like an iron law that it would be completely blasphemous to add to what I found. Writing about the Gulag, which doesn't have this sepulchral glow that the Holocaust has, partly because it's so under-remembered comparatively, so under-honored, that there isn't such a sense of violating a decorum by visiting it in your mind. This book was infinitely more difficult to write than Time's Arrow, because it was about a victim or two victims. And that's an enormous presumption. And it's especially embarrassing if, like me, you were writing it in Uruguay in subtropical ease with your beautiful wife and beautiful daughters and leading a completely stressless existence. And we've all seen those satirical cartoons where the novelist is by the swimming pool yelling for his second cocktail before lunch, and turning around to type, you know, the next morning the third child died, you know. And I was completely incapable of doing that. And what I did, not to go on about it, because I'm as if I had a terrible time, you know, that's exactly what I don't mean. But I did have to suffer. And I couldn't suffer in penal servitude above the Arctic Circle. That wasn't something I could opt to do. And I didn't sit there, you know, perhaps once a week I would feel just how bloody awful it was for the people who were there and how sorry I felt for them and what a miserable degradation and injustice it was and incredible abuse of state power, etc. You can't do that all day for 10 months. But what you can do, as every writer knows, is you can do the suffering of the study, which is getting in there every morning full of anxiety and finding that that the page, the scene, the chapter is dead. And you know, you normally expect your unconscious mind to be doing a good deal of the work, and when you come to a scene, you expect your unconscious to have prepared the way. And that didn't happen at all. It was as if my unconscious was switched off, unplugged. So I was having to gouge every scene into life as if by an act of will. And I thought this novel is imploring me to abandon it. It doesn't want to be written by me. And it was only when I'd reached a point, an almost suicidal point, where I was talking to some friends about, the conversation was about literature, and I thought, that's no longer got anything to do with me. That's all gone. I don't think of myself as a writer anymore, because it was so deadening in the study. And then, you know, that was the bottom I hit, and then a couple of days later, it all began to lift. Then I finished it feeling not too bad about it. And then when the proofs came two or three months later, I picked them up with trembling hands. And I have to say, I was very favorably impressed by what I read. And the only odd feeling was that it felt as though it had been written by someone else. And I don't mean by the narrator, but by another writer. So that was the journey there.
Given the amount of reading that you had done with Koba, did you expect this to be a much easier novel to write, though, and all the research you'd done?
Well, I'd done a lot of reading of, you know, nonfiction and some fiction for the nonfiction book. They hardly overlapped, you know, in my mind. I did all that reading, and then 3 years later, as often happens, I find something you've absorbed as a journalist might, or an amateur historian, it sinks down, trickles down into the bit of you where fiction comes from, and you find you have more to say from further in, a more intimate, emotional slant. And then it's a completely different, you know, there's no moral or emotional difficulty in writing what is in fact amateur history. You're not engaged at, you know, the real sources of your being as you are in fiction. So I didn't expect it to be as hard as I did, but I didn't expect it to be easy. I knew it would be a much more difficult thing than writing nonfiction about it. That it would ask more of me. I mean, by definition, a novel does. I mean, that's what novels do. That's why novelists are so touchy and egotistical. It's because most artists, when they do their art, all they're displaying is their talent. That's almost true of poetry, even. But the novelist shows everything about himself, not just his talent, but his social, psychological, sexual being is all folded inside out and presented to the world. And you're never more vulnerable than when you do that.
Another question. All the way in back. If you'd keep your hand up, sir, please. Yes. Please keep your hand up.
I can't help but wonder, from the way that you structured the book, that it's not a telling of a story so much as it is a retelling of a story, and it's from a Russian to an American. And I can't imagine anything that you do that was as excruciating as the process that you just described was in any way by accident. So I would have to think that there is some thrust of dialogue that's being suggested by the way that you put the book together. And this discussion is between the United States and Russia. And what is that discussion?
Well, in the sense that it's addressed to his American stepdaughter, that's true. And it was making it an address to his 24-year-old black American stepdaughter that was an enormous breakthrough for me. She was in the first draft of the book, Venus, his stepdaughter, but only in one scene. And when I made that the focus of it all, then there was hardly a difficulty it didn't solve, except the struggle for legitimacy in writing about a victim. But, you know, Venus is 24-year-old American, and she has as he teases her, she has the modern ideology. And we all know what that is. It has lots of names, sometimes called Westernism, levelism, multiculturalism, relativism, political correctness. It's our ideology, or it's the ideology of our young. And he has very good reason to fear ideology. And in fact, he says, I've always tried to interest you in my ideology, which is the ideology of no ideology. Ideology is a terrible thing. What's it ever given us? As he says, you know, political correctness is a mild enough ideology. Mildness is, in fact, is one idea. And no one's going to blow themselves to bits for political correctness. But it's still an ideology. And this is what's wrong with ideologies, is that even one as mild as the current one is always on the brink of violence. Not physical violence in this case, but other emotional violence. And the reason for that is that all ideologies, very much including religion, which is an ideology, is that it involves illusion by definition, because no belief system explains everything. We know that by now. So you're pretending this one does. And that's all right. You can go on pretending. You pretend. In fact, political correctness is more like a series of polite fictions than an actual illusion. You pretend everyone's equal, and you can pretend that for a bit, and even though your senses are telling you 1,000 times a day that it isn't the case. But having signed on to this illusion, and in fact having invited two people to live inside your head, one of them is a commissar who looks very stern if you step out of line. The other one is a cheerleader who jumps up and down every time you say something that's right. If this ideology, whatever it is affronted or challenged, then its response can only be violent, because it can't defend the illusion with work of mind alone. You can say in a louder voice, God does exist. But you can't, for religions in particular, no evidence is offered for them. Therefore, they can be dismissed without evidence. But the ideologue or the religionist will find that when challenged, his fists are tightening and his neck is getting hot, because there's nothing else to defend it with, is there? So ideologies also submit you to the humiliation of being part of a crowd, moving with the crowd, with the herd. And as he says to his stepdaughter, inasmuch as you're ideological, that's the only part of you that I sense is not really free. It's a self-shackling, an ideology.
We'll take one more question right in the middle there. Keep your hand up, please.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm here with my 12th grade AP English class right now, and we actually just finished reading Time's Arrow and enjoyed some lively discussions on it. It was great. My question today is, what is your advice to aspiring novelists and students like me who have faced writer's block and intimidation and are just confused right now? What's your advice for that?
I have two excellent bits of advice that I've only really formulated fairly recently, and I wish to Christ that some wise and kindly 57-year-old writer had taken me aside when I was 25 and told me these two things. They won't sound very dramatic, but I promise you they'll both help. One is, if you come up against a difficulty, which could be a block or could be just that you've gone down the wrong turning and actually need to retreat and think again about some earlier decision, don't sit there and, as I would have done as a 25-year-old, and bang your head against it and try and get past it and or through it. I now do this on automatic. If that happens, I find I'm, you know, a couple of minutes later, I'm not at my desk anymore. My legs, it's more physical than you think. My legs have taken me from my desk and deposited me in an armchair, and I'm reading a book. And I don't want to go to my desk. And then after a few hours, or maybe a day or two, I'm back at my desk. Didn't decide to, but my legs have taken me back there. The sort of aura of revulsion surrounding your desk has dissipated. And what has happened is that your unconscious has solved the difficulty. My father used to have a different method, which was, he said mentally he'd have to come up to himself and say, "Now what's wrong?" And then he'd answer, "It's the first chapter." And then he said, what is it about the first chapter? "That's the first couple of pages, you know." And he'd have to sort of baby himself out of it. But the other bit of advice is this, and very liberating, I think, this one, is that a novel has been defined as a piece of prose with something wrong with it. And in fact, more accurately, it could be said, a novel is a piece of prose with several things wrong with it. But you're often, when writing something, there's one big trouble with it, and you know that it's a trouble, and you're wondering how to get around it, and you actually feel very furtive about it. And when your wife says, how are things going in the study, and you say, "I'm fine, thank you." And my advice with that, and there almost always should be something wrong with it. It's sort of the nature of the thing. It's an imperfect, inexact art. But the thing to do is state it in the page, on the page, state it. Say what the difficulty is. And then you may even go back and take that out when you've begun to feel more relaxed about it. But then it stops being a secret. That's very important psychologically. It stops being the thing you dread reviewers saying about it. When you, Mr. Ames doesn't seem to have realized that, you know. So you've got to show you're aware of the difficulty. And then it sort of evaporates. I was writing this, and now quite... I'm now quite near the end of it, long, blindingly autobiographical novel. Also, all the things I said that people hate these days, like essayistic, static, inert, and all that. But autobiographical, and pretty much in the past, since my first novel, I've left myself alone in fiction. And doing an expressly autobiographical novel felt all wrong. And I kept thinking, only Saul Bellow has ever got anywhere with real people and real situations. Others have got somewhere with it. He's the only one who's been able to stare at individuals, at real things, and see through them the universal, whereas novelists attempt the universal the other way around, where they try and arrange imaginary events to point to the universal. So I thought, you know, this isn't going to work. I wasn't trying to write like Saul, but so I just wrote. I came back to it after writing this. I broke off to write this and came back to it, and then I found myself typing the sentence: "The truth does not lend itself to fiction." And after that, everything was fine.
Well, here's to the truth. Thank you, Martin.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Folks, give us 5 minutes for a smoke break, and we'll meet you upstairs at the table.
Can we have a smoke break?
Yeah. Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.